Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front Line.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
Hi, I had a play and I was singing all the songs to be a little girl, and I was in the second play in Green Stages.
Okay, wait a second. You got to say, it is Wednesday, July 13th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and...
No, Myla Cedar.
Well, my name is Sam Cedar, and your name is...
Myla Cedar! And thank you so much, everyone. I'm so glad that you can see here. It's July. And today's the first day of July.
Well, no, today's not actually the first day of July. That happened in the past. We are in the future, Myla. It is Wednesday, July 6, 2011. I am on vacation. Myla and I are hanging out. We're having fun. At this point, we've probably gotten to fights with each other, right? And today on the program, Susan Saladoff. She is the filmmaker who created the film.
And my mom is a filmmaker.
That's true.
She used to be a filmmaker.
No, she still is. And she created the film Hot Coffee. Hold on for a second, kiddo. The film Hot Coffee about tort reform. Fascinating interview. 30 minutes long. All new. Enjoy it, folks. Don't forget, coming up this week, foreign bloggers, my interview with Senator Al Franken at Netroots Nation, and Marcos Melitzis. Stick around. And enjoy.
And tell him that I'm going to talk.
Well, how about you talk? We'll do one more and you can talk, okay?
Ready?
Okay, no. Later. Okay. Enjoy, folks. So on the phone, I am talking to Susan Saladoff. She is the filmmaker, the director of Hot Coffee, which can be found at hotcoffeethemovie.com, and it's currently playing on HBO. You can see it on HBO. They're going to present it live about 10 more times, and it's, of course, available on HBO On Demand. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's start. Your movie is it's fantastic. I think every American should see this. But and I thought the story that you focused on, which the movie's title is based upon, that you, to enter into this this topic of so-called tort reform and Americans' access to the courts for some type of civil compensation for damages that are inflicted upon them by corporations as consumers or workers was fascinating. So tell us about the story of Stella Liebeck. Most people think they know this story, but they don't really.
Right. So this is the woman who was basically made fun of by, in our television shows and in the media, the woman who spilled coffee and sued McDonald's. And most people believe that, you know, she was, you know, driving the car and she wasn't seriously injured and she was just looking to make a quick buck. To be honest, I mean, that's information was what was fed to the American public. On the night of the verdict, Jane Pauley, who was sitting in for Tom Brokaw on the NBC Nightly News, reported to the American public the wrong facts, that she, in fact, was driving. When this woman was 79 years old, she had never brought a lawsuit in her life. In fact, she was a very conservative person. She had worked up until about a week before this, and she was a passenger in a car that was being driven by her grandson. They went to McDonald's to get a McBreakfast sandwich, and she ordered a cup of 49-cent coffee. I don't know if you remember, this was almost 15 years ago, mm-hmm. but it was one of those old-fashioned styrofoam cups with the little flat plastic tops on it that, you know, you can never open that little triangular thing that's on top. And she asked for cream and sugar. They didn't put it in it. They put it in a bag. Her grandson moved into a parking spot, parked the car, and the car that she was in didn't have any cup holders or flat surfaces. So she wanted to put cream and sugar in it, and she put it, steadied it between her legs on the seat, and when she tried to open up the top, she couldn't open that little thing, so she pulled the top off, and the coffee was so hot that the cup literally collapsed, and the coffee spilled into her lap. The coffee was between 180 and 190 degrees Fahrenheit, which we know that to be a fact because that's McDonald's had a policy to hold the coffee at that temperature. And what they also knew was that coffee served at that temperature would cause third-degree burns, which are the worst kind of burns you can get, within 3 to 7 seconds of contact. And they had paid out over 700 times for other people who had been burned by hot coffee.
So we have this story of a woman who had become infamous and had become the poster child for everything that was wrong with trial lawyers and court abuse and tort reform abuse. And the first aspect of your film that I think is wonderful is that we never really knew the real story and the images of what happened to her. The pictures of what this scalding coffee caused is stunning. Now, she didn't set out to sue them for millions. What was her initial request to McDonald's?
All she wanted was the difference between what Medicare paid and what her medical bills were. That's what she asked them for. And you have to remember, as you said, these burns were so severe that she had to have skin grafting, skin literally taken from her thighs and sewn into her private parts. She was incapacitated she was in the hospital for 8 days and incapacitated for almost 2 years. And all she asked for were her medical bills. And McDonald's offered $800 and never offered another penny.
And the stunning thing that came out in the trial is that, like you say, there were 700 documented cases. Now, who knows how many there actually were, but there were documented cases that McDonald's had documentation.
We know there were more because the lawyer who was representing Mrs. Liebeck had actually represented another person who had been burned by hot coffee 6 years earlier and had taken the deposition of the quality assurance man that's in the film. And that person's name wasn't on the list that was given to him by McDonald's. So on cross-examination, he said to this quality assurance man, he says, well, where's Mrs. So-and-so, the one who had represented? Why isn't her name on the list? And he says, well, I don't know. And he says, well, how many other people's names are not on this list who were burned by hot coffee? And the jury got really angry. As you know, we have, you know, two jurors in the film, and they are as reasonable as anybody else. I mean, they're reasonable people who listen to a week's worth of testimony. It was a unanimous verdict, and the verdict was literally just her medical bills, and the judge told the jury to consider punitive damages, which is to deter or punish the defendant for conduct that's reckless or that they knew would cause harm. And the jury awarded 2 days of coffee sales for McDonald's as the punitive damage award, which is a lot, $2.7 million, but it was just 2 days of coffee sales. And then the judge wound up reducing that amount to $480,000, and then they appealed, and then they wound up settling it for, we don't know what the amount is, but it was probably a smaller amount.
Right. We don't know what the amount is because you have to sign a non-disclosure form. And so all the time that this woman, Stella Liebeck, was being maligned, she couldn't talk about the details of this case.
That's very common. When people settle these cases, usually the plaintiff or the one who's injured is subject to a gag order. So it's a confidentiality agreement. They're not allowed to say anything, but the other side isn't subject to the same gag order. So all of this misinformation and distortions about the fact were being continually repeated in the press. You know, Seinfeld did a whole episode on it, and she couldn't say anything.
Right. And I have to admit that, you know, if you had asked me 3 weeks ago before I watched your movie, about that incident, I would give more or less this Reader's Digest version that would have been like, I would have probably said something to the effect of like, tort law, and we'll get into this in the next segment, but the tort law is incredibly important to protect consumers and workers, you know, but occasionally you get a case like that coffee thing. And so there was a concerted effort to spin this in such a way and hoodwink even, you know, the writers of Seinfeld, for that matter, who probably knew more about the case than your average person does. But let me ask you this, and this is an important thing before we go into the next segment, because I want to talk about the reasons why this false narrative was created. But why did McDonald's keep their coffee that hot? I mean, what is the equation? In so many of these cases, there is an equation for the corporation that saves them money despite the small payouts they have to make. Why do they keep it that hot?
So, you know, that's a very good question. And all I can tell you is what was testified to at trial. I don't know the real reason because McDonald's refused to talk to me when I was making this film. But they testified that they put on, you know, sort of the Juan Valdez of coffee on the witness stand. And he testified that coffee tastes best when it's served between 180 and 190 degrees. What's so absurd about that is that the quality assurance representatives testified you cannot drink coffee at between 180 and 190 degrees because it will burn you. And so I can't say what the real reason is other than, as you said, it has to be an economic reason. Many people have made the assumption or the guess that it was probably the coffee stays fresher longer when it's at that temperature, because it has to be a reason that saves them money. But I don't know the true reason.
Right. I mean, if you have 700 complaints that you've had to deal with, pay out a small amount of money or whatever it is, there has to be a calculation somewhere in that boardroom that says, if we keep the coffee at this temperature, it saves us this amount of money. Even when we subtract the amount that we have to pay out to people that we hurt. And this is what torts and what trial lawyers and civil litigation is all about. We've got to take a break, but we will talk about the other aspects of this movie, Hot Coffee, when we return. Talking to Susan Saladoff. She is the filmmaker who created Hot Coffee. You can see more information about it at hotcoffeethemovie.com. It's playing on HBO and should be widely distributed, hopefully, by fall. So we've talked about the lead-in story. This is the sort of apocryphal story, the famous story of the woman who sued McDonald's because she was burned by their coffee. And you've told us just how – what were the forces that kept us in the dark about this narrative, the actual reality of what was going on there, and why do they do this?
So let's put this in the context of what was happening politically at the time. The verdict came out in August of 1994. President Bill Clinton was in office, but in that fall election, the Congress flipped Republican. And Newt Gingrich became the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years, and he had his contract with America. And in that contract was legal reform or tort reform. You know, as you know from the film, very few people know what a tort is, let alone know what tort reform is. And yet we're essentially being asked to vote for either candidates who are for or against this, or sometimes for constitutional amendments about it in many election cycles. And people have strong opinions and most of the time don't have a clue as to what it is. But what it is, and what we document in the film, are all the different ways that our constitutional rights to access the court system are being taken away from us as average citizens. And when we cannot access the court system any longer, then those who make products that harm us, those who dump millions of gallons of oil into our streams, those people cannot be held accountable, because they become immune when we can't access the court system. And so politically, at the time that this verdict came out, there was this attempt to limit people's, average people's access to our third branch of government or our courts. And when the McDonald's verdict was rendered, and when all the distortions came out, oh, this woman spilled coffee and sued and got millions of dollars, and all this ridiculous, you know, media frenzy went on with it, the people who were trying to get tort reform passed, they grabbed onto the stories. They grabbed onto the distortions and the misrepresentations and perpetuated it to, and used it as the poster child for what's wrong with our civil justice system. And that's how it became so famous.
Now, I've said many times on this program that that when you have the attacks that we have on our regulatory agencies on a government level, when you have the revolving door with industry people populating these regulatory agencies, the last essential firewall between the idea that corporations can make this central calculation that it is cheaper for us to pay off a couple of people who die or are hurt by our policies, whether they're consumers, whether we're talking about the famous Ford Pinto case, or whether it's Massey Mines, where they cut corners when they're going in mining, and they may have to pay off occasionally here or there a fine or this and that. That's the calculation they make. These type of tort laws are the one thing that actually changed the behavior of corporations. And one of the things that I found fascinating about your film, Hot Coffee, was that I never knew of the direct connection. I understood ideologically that there were people, let's say, in the Republican Party who wanted to have corporations be unfettered by this type of sort of almost civil regulation in some way. But there was a direct connection between these corporations and between this this so-called tort reform movement and Karl Rove and George W. Bush.
Yeah, well, most people have no idea that Karl Rove was a consultant for the tobacco industry at the same time that he was working to get George Bush first governor and then president. And the tobacco industry, of course, made a product that killed people. And when the court started to be used, just as you're saying, to hold wrongdoers accountable, and just as an aside, what you say is so true, many, many wrongdoers, corporations, people in general, they tend not to take responsibility for their wrong actions until it affects their pocketbook. And all of a sudden, when it costs more money to pay out on these claims than it is to actually make a product that's safe enough for all of us to consume, that's when they change their behavior. And that's the role of the civil justice system, when we can hold those wrongdoers accountable. And so back when Karl Rove was a political strategist for Bush, he was also beholden to the tobacco industry. And what he realized, very brilliantly, I must add, is that this issue of limiting liability for corporations was not a Texas issue, for example, even though George Bush was running for governor of Texas. It was an issue that could bring money in from corporations all over the country. And so it became the rallying cry for many in the Republican Party so that they could raise money from all of these corporations and to limit their liability. And that is how it became such a popular issue. And then, of course, when George Bush became president, it became one of his central issues of his presidency. As you remember from the film, I mean, every State of the Union address, it was like, you know, we need to limit these lawsuits. We have to stop these frivolous lawsuits. And again, most people don't know that the reason that they know these terms, frivolous lawsuit, greedy trial lawyer, jackpot justice, lawsuit lottery, is because they were market-tested terms. They were wordsmithed and repeated over and over again, so that eventually people started like knowing them as if they were in their own lexicon.
Yeah, it's stunning. I mean, this is such a real sort of political twofer for the Republicans. One, there was a natural intersection of agendas here. Large corporations who want to be able to essentially help their bottom line by getting away with cutting corners and putting consumers and workers at risk. I mean, that's not their plan. We don't plan to put consumers and workers at risk, but we want to save money, and we do. We have an actuarial chart. We can guess how much it's going to cost us, and unless a trial lawyer comes in and makes us pay much more, we're not going to change our behavior. So you had this political alignment with Republicans on that end of the spectrum, and also a way to make money for Karl Rove, which also dovetailed into sort of that synergy between running George Bush and helping these corporations. And it turns out that this is a way to intimidate and to dry up trial lawyer money, which is a big donors to the Democratic Party.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you prevent people from having access to the courts or you put limits on it, then, you know, those, if you can't bring these cases anymore, then you're essentially taking away the livelihood of the people who are representing those individuals. And many of those are the largest donors to some of the Democratic candidates. But what's even more insidious than that is that there started to be these political prosecutions, as we know from the Oliver Diaz case that's highlighted in the film, which was the subject of John Grisham's fictionalized version in the appeal. So there was this, there were these political prosecutions that started to be brought to intimidate pro-consumer or judges in particular who were not as pro-corporate as some of these interests wanted them to be, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which, you know, most people don't know is not a U.S. Part of the U.S. government.
Well, I have to say that anybody listening to this program knows that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you're right, the public at large is sadly unaware of just of the actual agenda of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But the movie is Hot Coffee Movie. It is on HBO. People should check it out, and they can check out the website at hotcoffeethemovie.com. So, Susan, all right, let's move on. Let's talk about that Diaz case, because I've actually followed not the Diaz case, but more from the side of Paul Miner. But and so I didn't even understand just how much they were going after this Diaz. Who was Diaz or is Diaz? And just tell us briefly about that case.
Sure. So it's Oliver Diaz. Was a Mississippi State Supreme Court justice. He was originally appointed and then had to run for office in 2000. And what happened was is that Oliver sometimes voted for consumers. He wasn't always, you know, straight the line for corporations.
That's horrible.
And so he was targeted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who had which had decided to be starting to funnel money into these judicial campaigns all over the country. In most of our states now, we elect our judges. And when we elect judges, they have to run for office and they have to raise money. And so they're beholden to the people who are giving them large amounts of money.
And these races, I should say, are much more susceptible to money than your average, statewide races, because they generally don't get that much money. So if somebody steps in with a couple $100,000, that fundamentally alters the nature of the contest.
Not only that, the candidate that usually has the most amount of money unfortunately wins most of the time just because of that, because they've got the money to do ads on television, and it's mostly about television ads that really make the difference. Well, what was happening that most people have no idea is that there were these front groups that were being set up, and they always had names that sounded like there were citizens in them, and that they were all about, you know, anti-crime, you know, citizens for a safer community or citizens against crime something, whatever. They never had any citizens in them. They were organizations or front groups that were set up by the public relations firms for these large corporate interests, and then they would funnel money into those campaigns using these front groups and have, you know, buy up all the television ads, you know, in the state, in the guise of these front groups, attacking the judge that they want off or promoting the judge that they've basically handpicked to go on their courts. And we're talking about our state Supreme Courts, which are the highest courts in each of our states. And what was happening was, in many states, there were these laws that were being enacted to put caps on damages in personal injury cases, and they were being found to be unconstitutional, because we do have, most people don't know this, but the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution is trial by jury, and that constitutional provision is violated when you put the caps on damages, because we're supposed to allow our juries to make the determination.
Right. I think in the movie somebody made the point, like, we allow juries to sentence someone to death. We don't give, you know, the idea that we would not allow juries to make the distinction between $200,000 in this case or $5 million in this case is absurd. It's unconstitutional.
And so what was happening was that our state Supreme Courts were being essentially bought and paid for by these large corporate interests, so that when these laws would come up to the Supreme Courts of the states, they would uphold them. They would uphold these caps on damages. Or in the alternative, when people would go to trial, and even if they're lucky enough to get a verdict by a jury, which is not easy to do in these conservative and also in these conservative environments, and also where the jurors are led to believe that somehow it's coming out of their own pocketbooks, but when they're even lucky enough to win a case and the defendants held accountable, these cases are appealed up to our state Supreme Courts, and oftentimes they're overturned.
Now, we should make it clear that we're talking about in the state court system. So why wouldn't the U.S. Constitution nullify what a state Supreme Court said about juries being able to awards being capped?
Okay, so let me back up a little bit. So even though we have the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution is in our federal system, we've never actually had a federal cap on damages yet. Although our Congress is trying to do it right now with the health care reform bill, they've actually are trying to get a $250,000 cap on damages for medical malpractice cases, but it's not gone to the Senate yet, and it hasn't. Hopefully, President Obama won't agree to that, as he says in our film. He doesn't believe in caps. But at the state level, we have state constitutional provisions that are very similar. And so when I was talking before about these cap statutes being overturned as unconstitutional, they're usually done that by the state constitution.
Right. Okay. And so we have this situation. So Diaz is not corporate enough for them, and he is looking for a loan, essentially, right, to run one of his campaign races. He gets a loan. But go ahead. You tell us.
What actually happened is that there was a runoff. He and his opponent wound up having to have a runoff. And when that happened, the U.S. Chamber dumped a lot of money through one of these front groups for his opponent, and basically bought up all the television station time in the state of Mississippi. And so he had to combat that, and he had to borrow money to do that. And so he borrowed money from a very good friend of his,
Paul Miner.
Right. And what happened was is that after he actually won the election, and then he was prosecuted essentially for accepting a bribe, even though it was a loan from Paul Miner, and he had never voted for any case in which Paul Miner or anyone from his office ever came before him because of this loan and because of this friendship. But despite that, he was prosecuted, and although he was completely acquitted, he was off the bench for 3 years fighting these false charges. And so then when he tried to run for election again, his reputation was tainted, he couldn't raise enough money, and he eventually lost.
Now, there's a couple aspects of this. This dovetails with the story of the U.S. attorneys that were corrupted under the Bush administration. This dovetails into the story of the firings of the U.S. attorneys and the use of Karl Rove to punish political opponents with the use of U.S. attorneys. We saw it in multiple cases across the country where these U.S. attorneys did stuff like this, used their power. And was he prosecuted by a U.S. attorney?
He was, and you know, we don't go into the details, obviously,
right,
of all
this
of that.
A...
We could do an entire movie on just what you're talking about
right
now.
And actually, I'm not convinced somebody shouldn't, because Paul Miner is still what happened to Paul Miner?
Well, Paul Miner, unfortunately, was found criminally at fault, not with respect to Oliver, but with respect to some other judges. He was acquitted on the charges around Oliver Diaz. But now most of his charges have been overturned. But nevertheless, he's still in jail on a very as far as I understand, it's not legitimate that he's in jail after the Scully verdict, you know,
right,
when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that he I forget what the charge is, but at this point, I don't think that Paul Miner should be in jail any longer at all.
And this is, like I say, this ties into the whole U.S. attorney. Now, you don't deal with it in the film, but maybe there's your next film. But let's talk about, and we just have a couple more minutes here. Then the fourth exhibit that you present in your film is the notion of arbitration. Now, just a couple of months ago, or maybe not even a couple of months, maybe a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court essentially not only shut the door to any type of class action in arbitration cases, they actually overrid a California statute that said that you could have class actions in arbitration cases. That's if AT&T charges everybody $32 more than they should have on their bill because of some shenanigans. You need people to gather. But you cover arbitration clauses in employment agreements, and you do a particularly horrific case. Tell us about that case.
Yeah, so what most people don't realize is that, you know, we're being asked to sign in contracts every day. And sometimes we're not even asked to sign. If you just use your cell phone or your credit card, you're agreeing to these clauses that are usually in the fine print or embedded in these contracts called mandatory arbitration. And most people don't ever think that you're ever going to have a dispute with the company that you're signing these contracts with. And then if you ever do have a dispute, the company that you're having the dispute with, they get to pick the decision maker. They get to pay for the decision maker. The decision maker doesn't have to give a reason why he or she comes up with the decision. It's completely secretive, and there's no right to appeal.
That's the amazing thing about these arbitrators. Let me just say that, I think your film made a great point about they're essentially like the same. It's the same relationship like Moody's, who gave AAA ratings to mortgage pay. Securities. You know, the idea is that there's one party that comes into this arbitration that has the opportunity to keep coming back and paying you as an arbitrator, and that is always the corporation, never the individual.
Right, and they're completely biased. And as you saw from the film, the times when consumers win is almost never.
Right.
The businesses win time and time again. And I wanted to use a case to show how that's affecting all of us, and it's happening right now. We do it all the time. And so I highlighted the case of Jamie Lee Jones. She was 19 years old. She lived in Houston, Texas, and went to work for Halliburton in their IT department. Halliburton is a big, big employer in Houston. And she signed her employment contract. And embedded in the employment contract was one of these mandatory arbitration clauses. And not only did she not really know what it was, but, you know, who's going to not sign the contract when you need the job, and who knows what those things or ever thinks it's ever going to be a problem? Well, she was given a promotion to go to Iraq, and was told that when she went there, she would live in a little trailer house with another woman. When she gets there, she's put into a dorm with 400 men. And she complained to Halliburton, said that wasn't what she was promised, and they said, oh, get over it. On the fourth day that she's there, she's drugged and gang-raped by her Halliburton co-employees. And when you are a contractor in a foreign country with the U.S., there's no criminal liability from the authorities in the country, and we don't bring criminal action against a contractor in a foreign country. So there were no criminal charges brought against these men. So she wanted to bring a claim in the civil courts against Halliburton for putting her in this unsafe condition, and also because they knew that this had happened to other women in the past. And so she filed a case against Halliburton, and they said, oh, no, you can't do that. You signed this arbitration clause in your employment contract. Well, she didn't want to go to arbitration because she found out at that point that these are so biased. There had been other women who had been raped and who also went through these arbitration, and she never knew about it because they were all secretive. So she has been trying for the last 6 years, essentially, to get into the court system. And right this minute, she actually is in court in Houston, Texas. The case is going on right now. And the only reason that happened was because Senator Al Franken filed a bill as part of the Defense Appropriations Bill, saying that contractors who contract with the U.S. can't put these clauses in their contracts, and that bill actually did pass. And then Halliburton dropped its appeal, and then they were able to go to trial. But what I'm talking about, you look in your real estate contracts, your mortgage contracts, your car loan contracts. your gym membership contracts. These clauses are everywhere now.
And people should understand that Al Franken is not going to be able to pass an amendment that is going to essentially give us all our chance at our day in court because they're not being paid by the U.S. government. That's not something that's going to pass.
No, but what is pending now, he did, after the AT&T versus Concepcion case that you just referenced, which mm-hmm. also is now allowing companies to put in their contracts these ban on class actions, which nobody really cares about until you get screwed, you know, for a small amount of money, and you go, wait, I don't have any rights here. And, you know, these companies are making millions of dollars, you know, essentially taking away small amounts of money from each of us, you know, from mm-hmm. millions of us. And so now companies are allowed to do that based on that AT&T case. So Senator Franken has reintroduced in the Senate, and Bruce Braley, who's also in the film, he's a congressman from Iowa, has introduced in the House the Arbitration Fairness Act. And what that act, what that bill will do is prevent these clauses from being in all of our contracts. I mean, when you buy anything on the internet, as you know, before you can buy it, you now have to say, I agree to some, you know, clause, and everybody has to agree because you can't get it otherwise.
Right.
And so we need to contact our congresspeople, and we need to make sure that these clauses come out of all of our contracts.
Well, Susan Saladoff, the film is Hot Coffee. People can get more information about it at hotcoffeethemovie.com. It's on HBO. It's on HBO on demand. It'll be on DVD hopefully in the fall and hopefully with some theatrical release. It's a great film. We've talked extensively about it, and I'm going to watch the film, I think, probably two or three times. If every American in this country watched the film, I'm convinced it would radically change their perspective on what's going on in this country. So I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you and congratulate you on the film.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. Shifted it.